look at all the faces I love out there. That's so nice. Good morning. I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Riverside Group in Coral Springs. I've been a member of the Riverside Group for a long, long time. And I have an awesome sponsor. And she has an awesome sponsor, and they are both members of the Riverside Group, so I can't get away with anything. So and I was talking to my daughter the other morning, and I told her how nervous I was about this, and she said, well, just remember, you're supposed to imagine all of them without their clothes on. So if I'm looking at you funny, you don't know. If I'm giggling, you probably do know. So. So this has been a wonderful lake. And I want to give tribute to my first sponsor who passed away way too young for bringing me to my first lake in April of 1987. She said that if I was good, she would take me to the lake. And I thought, oh, whoopee. You know, I didn't know what it was. And what a gift she gave me. This is such a part of my heart and soul. And I want to thank the committee for a great weekend. You guys rock. So, all right. I was born and raised in the suburbs of Philadelphia. It is a land of blue blood, gold coins, and Ivy League schools. And you either get it or you don't. It's very important how things look. Very important how they look. Not how they feel. If you feel bad, that's up to you to deal with. But it better look good from the outside. I was raised with the phrases, you know, what would people think? Oh, well, how would that look if you did that? So I have spent the rest of my life trying to unravel that, to just do something because it's right and not worry about how it looks. And it's taken me years. This is by no means a criticism of my family. It's how everyone lived. I was, I'm an only child, so by nature I was spoiled. And I had two parents who loved each other very much, and they loved me very much, and there wasn't any doubt about that. I never felt not loved. I was the beneficiary of an excellent education and all the things that come with privilege. And that's what that area of the country affords you. The only problem with this beautiful scene was that my dad was an alcoholic. And none of us knew what that was or what it entailed, least of all my father. He was the love of my life, you know. Daddy's little girl, and I didn't understand how he could then behave like he did when he got drunk. He was a periodic drunk, not a daily mess, but I didn't understand how he could behave like that, and it made my mother cry, and it made me frightened, and I was overwhelmed by all of it. My mother and I had this little routine when he would start to drink. This will tell you how old I am. We used to run around the house and unplug all the telephones and hide them under the bed because he had, besides alcoholism, telephonitis, and he called everyone he ever knew when he was drunk, and I was to inherit that part of his disease. So he eventually got sober in this program, and he died sober, and it was a great thing to watch. I did all the stuff he did when you grow up. You know, I was a nerd in elementary school, total dork, and I got bullied and left out of the games and left out of the parties and all that. And after elementary school, they sent me off to this girls' private school, and I convinced my mother that she wasn't dressing me anymore, that I was going to have, I was going to participate in my wardrobe choices, because hers were very dorky. And there was a girl in my class who had a big crush on my cousin, and so she was in the in crowd, so she sort of had to be nice to me, because otherwise I would say bad things to my cousin. And so that put me in with the in crowd. And I'm not happy to tell you that I turned into a mean girl. You know, one of those girls that was in the in crowd and looked down her nose at you. And I wasn't necessarily rude. I was just dismissive. And I was a bitch, let's just face it. And I just thought I was terminally cool, but I was not. And somewhere around the age of 14 or 15, oh, I didn't tell you, and you'll probably understand this. I never, ever believed that you were my friend. You could say you were my friend, you could hang around, but I couldn't find it in me to believe you. I thought that the real friendship somehow took place when I was out of the room. That if you took my so-called friends and backed them up against the wall and had made them tell you the truth, they would say, well, Gail's okay, but no, I don't really like her. And there really wasn't a reason for me to feel this way, but I don't ever remember not feeling that way until I came to you. I never really believed that I was liked or accepted. I have no idea, but I find it to be a common trait among us. So anyhow, in high school, I found this magic combination, and it worked really well for years. Boys and booze. What more could a girl ask? And, you know, I had a good-looking guy standing here, and that warm stuff spreading throughout my chest and stomach. I was pretty. I was popular. I could dance. And if this guy didn't work out so well, there was a good-looking one back there that, you know, maybe we could look at him too, you know, that just in case this one didn't work. I always had an insurance policy, a backup plan. And that was a combination that served me very well for many years, partying, boys and booze. I graduated from high school. I went off to college, and I found that being queen bee at a really small girls' private school in the Northeast didn't transfer well to a huge university in the Midwest. They were not impressed with me at all. And I was baffled. But the neat thing out there, I went to school at the University of Colorado, is that you could drink when you were 18. And they had this disgusting stuff called 3-2 beer. Oh, but what it lacked in alcohol, the altitude compensated for. And so I managed to get very drunk very often in college. About that time, my dad had a heart attack, and the doctors wanted him to move to Florida where it was warm. And so they had me come home to Philadelphia. We moved down to Florida. I was kicking and screaming. I called it an oven with a palm tree in it. I hated it down here. I couldn't believe they made me lead everything familiar. Never mind how they were feeling. But everything familiar was gone. But I soon discovered they had boys and booze in Florida. So, you know, and we lived really close to the beach, and it was fine. So I finished my sophomore year up at Palm Beach. Back then it was Palm Beach Junior College. Boy, I'm old. And then I got my bachelor's degree at Florida Atlantic University. And I graduated from college, and I didn't have a husband. which was kind of the goal back then when you went away to college, was to find the person you were going to marry. And it didn't work that way. And Lord, I had to get a job. And so I had a great job. I worked for Burdine, which is now Macy's, for those of you who don't know. And, I got a discount. I wore great clothes. I had so much fun. And eventually, I thought he was the right one, showed up. And he was exactly what your parents pray you will marry. He was educated. He was good looking. He had his head screwed on straight. And he had a good job. He made a lot of money. So my parents thought they died and went to heaven. And I thought that this was the right thing to do. And we had a beautiful wedding and all that. And we went off to white picket fence land. And but the thing is, I was still partying. I was still drinking. And he didn't like it that I still liked the boys and the booze. Who could you have? I don't understand. And we had a wonderful life. I was just an ungrateful soul. We had two beautiful children who remain the lights of my life today. We were married for 17 years, and then we just couldn't do it anymore. My drinking got worse. His workload kept him out of the house way too much, or maybe he stayed out of the house because of my drinking. You know, it's never been clear. He wasn't a great communicator. And but even I was starting to notice my own drinking. Denial goes only so far. And I desperately didn't want to be an alcoholic, because I knew if you were an alcoholic, you had to go to AA and you had to quit drinking. And I didn't want to quit drinking. I wanted to quit getting drunk. And so I tried all the stupid things we've tried. And I used to set the timer on the kitchen clock and say, okay, I'm not having another drink till this goes off. And of course, I'd had three by then. And just, I would stand some nights at the kitchen counter pouring the booze in the glass and saying, look at you. You're doing it again. And I didn't have the idea of the concept of powerlessness at that point. So in the middle of all of this, the person who loved me most in the world, my dad, died. And we had to go back up to Philadelphia to bury him. And at his funeral was my old high school sweetheart. And of course, my ego being what it was, I was sure he was there because he was still in love with me. But it turned out he was there because he had a drinking problem too. And he had called my father several years prior to that, knowing he was sober. And Dad had directed him to the rooms of AA. And he was he got to be for me what they tell us we might be. He was my first page of the big book, because I remembered him from our youth. And there he was with a nice crinkly smile. He had a wife and two kids and a mortgage and tuitions to pay. And oh, God help him, he worked for the IRS and all that. And you could just see that he was comfortable in his own skin. He had a twinkle in his eye. And I took that picture home with me. And my husband and I separated. He was living in Orlando and working. And I was at home one night. This was shortly after my father's death. And I passed out on the couch. My kids, fortunately, were still pretty young, so they were always in bed by the time I was drunk. They were not in bed when I started drinking, but they were in bed by the time I was drunk, so I've always felt a little good about that. And so I decided to call my friend in Philadelphia that night. I was very drunk. The kids were sound asleep, and my husband was out of town. And I can't tell you much about the conversation. I have this mental image of myself sitting on the kitchen floor with the phone on my shoulder and the bottle of scotch between my knees. And ladies don't drink out of the bottle. We pour it into a glass with ice cubes. And there was no glass, there was no ice cubes, there was me and the scotch bottle. And I called them up. I have no idea what time it was. I understand today that I was reaching out for help, but I didn't know anything. Maybe I thought he was going to come on his white horse and rescue me. I don't know. And I'm sure he and his wife were delighted to hear from this drunk woman down in Florida at 2 o'clock in the morning. And I don't really know what we talked about, but he was kind to me. And I got off the phone and went to bed. And when I woke up that next morning, I knew that something had to change. The morning wasn't any different than any other morning when I woke up and said, "Oh, God, you did it again." I woke up every morning and said that. I did it again. And the thing that beat me down was that I knew I would have to do it again that day, too. That it was never, ever going to end. And I sat there. I got the kids off to school somehow, and I sat there on the edge of my bed, and I knew about AA, but I didn't really want to quit drinking. I thought about suicide, but fortunately I'm very cowardly about things like pain, and there weren't enough pills in the house to do a good job. So I didn't really know what to do. And so I picked up the phone and I called Intergroup down in Fort Lauderdale. A woman named Gail answered the phone, which made me feel great. And my dad always went to his AA group at night at 8:30. So I thought all AA meetings were at 8:30 at night. Who knew? And so she said to me, "Oh, no, there's a meeting right near you at 10 a.m. this morning. Go there and you will find help." So she directed me to the old original Margate Club. And I grew up there. It was behind a gas station, next to a garage. It was just not in a nice neighborhood. And you all tell me stories of when you went to your first meeting and everybody was smiling and everybody was laughing and they were loving. Ha! I got out of my car, and in the parking lot, you could hear the argument going on inside this room. And I think I was pretty early because I just threw clothes on and went when she gave me the directions. And I walked into a room full of men who were having an argument about the Dolphins and Jets game the night before. And see what time of year it is. I don't know, but I know that as soon as I walked in that door, that the miracles started happening. They shut up. They quit yelling at each other. And one of them told me years later, "We looked at you and thought, oh, God, this broad needs a drink, you know." And I did. And this big, scruffy man came over to me. And I don't know if you ever tried to explain to someone how you feel. I always said I could be in the Orange Bowl with 60,000 people and I would be there by myself. But you can't explain that to a normal person. Another alcoholic gets it. And this big scruffy guy came over, and he was 6 foot something, and he put his hands on my shoulders and looked down at me, and I thought, he gets it. I knew he knew. And I said something about needing help. I don't really know what I said. And he took me over and put me in this armchair that had last seen springs during Adlai Truman, you know, sometime. I mean, when you sat in the armchair, you went to the floor. There was really no point in the chair. And they brought me a half a cup of coffee because I was shaking so badly. And they kept patting me. They just didn't know what to do with me. And because I was crying. And they kept saying, the women will be here soon. And I thought, well, whoopee, I don't care. I like guys, you know. And there, though, the women will be here soon. And then there was, I just remembered these hands with pamphlets. You know, they gave me all the AA pamphlets. And so I guess the women came, and somebody hauled me out of that chair and put me in a very uncomfortable folding chair right up by where the chairman sat, and said, you don't get sober over there, you get sober here. And I thought, okay, I'll sit here. And I don't remember a great deal about that meeting, but I remember that they directed it at me, the newcomer. And I saw these things up on the wall. I knew that there were steps in AA. I didn't know how many there were. I didn't know what they said. I didn't know anything. But I read the first step. And it's the word powerless. I mean, God, guys, I thought you hung it up there just for me that morning. I thought, that's it. That's what I was fighting against. I was powerless over alcohol. All my little tricks with switching to wine or setting the kitchen timer, those were all failed attempts to exert some power over alcohol. And here they are telling me I have none. And I thought, oh, powerless. Okay. I bought that right away. I guess I took the first step sitting there with the tears. I cried the whole hour. And there was a woman sitting on each side of me, patting me. Everybody patted me. And I'm here to tell you, you know when they say to you, look to your left, look to your right, only one of you will be here? Bullshit. Both those women are still sober today. That was September 22nd, 1986, and all three of us are still sober. So don't believe it. So I left there with a fistful of phone numbers and a lot of hope. It's the best I had felt probably in years. And when I left there, this older gentleman, I keep saying they were all old people, they were retired, they're probably what my age is now. But this old guy grabbed me and he said, okay, here's what you're going to do. They didn't really give me suggestions in those days. I think people were much more polite or politically correct now, but they just told me what the hell to do. And they didn't ask me if I believed in God. They just assumed that I was going to do this. And he said, when you go home, you're going to get down on your knees and you are going to give your drinking problem to God. And he said, please notice that I didn't tell you to ask him to help you. You're going to turn it over to him 100%. You're going to give it to God, because if there is anything you could have done, you would have already done it. Your part in this is over. It now belongs to God. And, you know, frankly, I would have done cartwheels down I-95 if you would have told me that it would make the pain get a little less. So I was willing to do what he said. Oh, and he also said, don't drink today and come back here tomorrow. He didn't say, you have to clean up your act. He didn't say you have to fix your marriage. He didn't say you have to stop screwing around with your friends' husbands. He didn't say any of that. He said, don't drink today and come back here tomorrow. I felt so accepted. I wasn't judged. I was understood. I was loved, and they wanted to help. I had never had felt like that in a room full of people before. I was always terrified about who liked me and who didn't. So I went home, my kids were still in school, and I did what that man said. I went in my bedroom and closed the door like somebody's going to see me praying, you know, the dog maybe. And the prayer, well, it turned out to be one that works for me 31 years later to this day. And it went something like, dear God, if you're there, I no longer say if you're there. But I didn't know if God wanted anything to do with me. because, you know, I was kind of not a good girl. And in spite of where I lived and how I looked and what I owned, I wasn't a good person inside. And I said, if you're there, I give up. I can't do this anymore. Please, you take this. And he did. It was just that simple for me. I'm not talking about burning bushes, but I'm talking about I felt a sense of relief come over me. I can't describe it any better than that. I got up off my knees and I sat down on the edge of the bed, and I really don't believe very much in spirits and ghosts and all those things, but the door to my bedroom was like over there, and I looked and my dad was standing there, and he went. I think he stuck around to make sure I was going to be all right, because it was just a few months after his death. I know for sure that that was him in that doorway. And so it was an interesting morning. I called my husband and told him where I'd been. And he said, well, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. I don't really think you're an alcoholic, but if you want to do that, that's fine, which shows you the state of communication in our marriage, because he was there when I passed out on the couch every night. He was there when I got drunk and embarrassing at parties. So, but he didn't think I had a problem. And then I debated about calling my mom. Now, my mom was an Al-Anoner and an AA wife for many years, but she had just buried her husband, and I didn't know if I wanted to call and tell her that her only beautiful, perfect child was an alcoholic. Turns out she knew I wasn't so beautiful and so perfect. But she burst into tears, and I thought, oh, you shouldn't have called. And she said, and I said, oh, Mom, I'm sorry if I upset you. And she said, no, you don't understand. I'm crying because I'm so happy for you. I thought she was nuts. How could you be happy for me? I can't ever drink again. You know, I didn't know what you did if you didn't drink. How do you not drink? My whole life was centered around it. I knew that alcoholics drank during the day, so I made it a point not to drink during the day. But when I got up in the morning, I know you all figure out what you're going to wear, what's going on at work, all that stuff, and I figured out what time I could legitimately pour my first drink. So they taught me that that was not normal. But at the point, that's all I knew was drinking. And so anyhow, my mother said, you have this beautiful life coming your way. And I'm so happy for you. And so my journey, my adventure began. And I did what they said. I went back the next day to that same meeting. And it was a great meeting because there were a lot of old-timers there. And I loved their experience, strength, and hope. And plus, I had kids at home, so it was perfect. So I went to that morning meeting for years and years. And I started hearing them talk about a sponsor. And I thought, what? And they said, well, you're best. Thinking and behavior got you in this room. So if you're going to recover from alcoholism, you need somebody to teach you how. I thought, okay, that makes sense. And they said, look for a girl. They were very clear that it was to be a woman who has what you want. And there was this woman, younger woman there. I was just about to celebrate my 40th birthday, and she was like in her early 30s, I guess. And I heard her say in a meeting one day that she had gotten in the rooms of AA the things that she'd been looking for when she was drinking. You know, happiness, stability, love, all those things we all want for ourselves. And I thought, okay, that's what I want. I want what she has. It also turned out she was legally blind, and so I asked her to be my sponsor, and she said, well, yes, but you have to call me every single day. Now, you need to understand, I didn't understand about sponsorship. I thought your sponsor was going to be your best AA friend. Ha. But I said to her, because I was a snot, and I thought my great good looks and checkbook, you know, that it just got things for me, and it didn't give me anything with her. Because I said to her, well, why can't you call me? I didn't know. And she said, because you don't have anything I want. And I thought, oh, you bitch. But I stayed with her, and I thought I was such a do-gooder that I picked up this poor blind woman every morning and took her to the meeting. Never mind, she could have walked. It was that close. Never mind, there were a million people who would have taken her, but she got me to a meeting every day of my life for a solid year. And we took her little girl, Nikki, with us, and we went shopping afterwards, and we went to lunch, and we talked, and we laughed, and we cried, and she, and I don't believe she couldn't see, because, you know, if my shirt wasn't buttoned up high enough, she'd say, fix that. We'd go to the beach, and back then I could wear a bikini, and she'd say, you keep your cover up on. And she just knew, you know. But, you know, really, you'd be driving, and she'd say, turn left here. I'd say, how do you know that? But she was awesome. She was tough on me personally, but with the steps, she took me through with such love. And such kindness and such compassion, and I don't think I could have done it any other way. And we did my third step on our knees in her living room in front of her couch. It was our altar. And I did my fifth step at Zuccarelli's Pizza. But never mind, she already knew everything that was in my fourth step, because every time I had a revelation, I called her up and said, oh, God, listen to this. You know, it's really been me all the time. And she said, oh, you got it. Because I thought it was you. I thought it was your fault that I was not happy, joyous, and free. But it was me. It was my fear, my self-centered fear. What if I can't have what I want? What if they don't like me? What if I'm going to lose what I get? Me, 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 me. What a revelation. I didn't have to worry about you anymore. I just had to take care of myself. Of course, that turns out to be a lifelong journey, but she was awesome. She was awesome. I don't know if I could have done it with anyone else. I think God chooses your friends very wisely and your sponsors. And so after, I don't know, a few days or a week or two, I noticed this man in the back of the room. I have to tell you about this because it's a huge part of me. And he was so scary looking. I went the long way around the room to get my coffee because I was too frightened to walk in front of him. Because I'm this little debutante from the main line, right? And here's this guy in leather and tons of gold jewelry, lots of tattoos, a big knife on his belt, and he said mother a lot. And I mean, he was really scary, but he was also a big deal. He was sober over a year, so that was a huge wow. I was excited about coming up on a 90-day trip. So, but I sort of thought he was cute. And I could tell that he sort of thought I was cute. And my so-called blind sponsor saw this. And she said, oh no, Gail. Of all the men in all the rooms, not that one. And, we were together 28 years when he died. He treated me with so much respect. We waited out my year. No relationships in your first year. We waited out my year. We went for hamburgers with a group of people after meetings. We had coffee together. He called me on the telephone, and he never so much as laid a hand on me. And when my year was up, he bought me the most beautiful medallion. And we started to go out as a couple. And we went very, 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 very slowly. And we got to know each other because I said, I don't want to wake up in bed one morning and look at you and think, oh, my God, I don't like him. So we wanted to make sure that we liked each other. And after 8 years, we got married. We came to the lake on our honeymoon. It was supposed to be a secret, only I bought the dress I got married in from a member of this program at Burdine's, and I swore her to secrecy, and 10 minutes later, everybody knew. So the AA grapevine is very, very efficient. And the committee gave us this really nice room in the motel across the street, and this room was so decorated. It was filled with crepe paper and balloons, and if you know Adie, she had hung the crepe paper because when you walked in the room, it hit you in the boobs. So... And those traditions were to continue over the years. My room was decorated. There were Burma Shave signs on US 27 that said Gail R. is 50 today. And over the years, and on my 60th birthday, there was, and just because the neighbors need to know this stuff, right? There was this huge sign on my front lawn. 60, big 6-0, and balloons and everything that somebody had come and put on my lawn at 2 a.m. I'm so glad they didn't get shot by Artie. It's how our life went. We had fun in AA, and we had friends in AA, and we had love in AA, and we traveled to international conventions, and we went to... the state convention every single year, and we just had fun. And as time went on, those steps that I had worked with my sponsor came off the page and came into me. They got down into my soul. So I almost never have to stop and think, what to do. I instinctively know how to handle a situation that used to baffle me. I also have a sponsor for that too. But it was interesting to watch that progression. I believe firmly that these steps are God-given. I believe that they have changed me to the core of my being. I don't even remember that stupid girl who showed up at that meeting. I don't remember how she thought, how she felt, and I can't believe how she behaved. But I know that our life together was a good one, a really good one, and that we had fine, fine friends and an enormous support system. Not to mention, I will give due to the Sober Motorcycle Club, of which he was a member. We have a member of that club sitting back there and another one somewhere. Jay? No, I guess not. I thought, motorcycles? A motorcycle club? There were all these people in leather, but they were, every single one of them was sober. And I was so snotty, you know, because I still thought I was superior when I met all these bikers. Until I went to a meeting one night and I heard one of them start his sentence with, well, back when I had 9 years, you know, and I think I had 11 months. So that taught me to reconsider my judgments. And I have learned that in this program. The snob is gone. The snot is gone. We were talking the other night, you know. I don't know about you, but I don't see color. I don't see age. I don't see sexual orientation. I don't see any of that. We might have a discussion about your politics, but I try to refrain. Look at Kathy. But this program has taught me love and tolerance and patience. It has given me joy. It has given me the respect of my children. Many years ago, my son was involved in a horrible car wreck, and five of his friends were killed in one night. We spent a week burying children. And every day I would come home from work, and my home would be filled with teenagers, totally quiet. You can imagine a house with 40 teenagers in it. I thought, oh, Lord, what's happening? And when I saw all the cars, and they were just sitting there talking to each other. They didn't know how to handle death. They didn't know what goes on at a funeral, none of it. And our sober home was where they came, just kind of instinctively. And I heard them talking about a funeral, and one boy asked me if he needed an invitation or a ticket. So we sat down and we talked about funerals. And our home has always been like that. It's been a haven for people, and I love it that way. So I there's just no telling you how much I've grown and changed. A couple years ago, well, my husband got sick a lot. He had a lot of medical issues, but he always recovered and always got back on the bike. And but this last time he did not. The last time he was at the lake, he ended up in the hospital. We stayed up here some extra time. And then we went home, and he was back in the hospital. And the doctor said, okay, Gail, he's not coming home until you call hospice, sign up with hospice. And I had resisted that so much. I needed the help desperately because I wasn't sleeping and I was taking care of him. And but I knew what that meant. But the angels from hospice came. Oh, God, what a blessing. I slept. And we have a little house on the water, and they put his hospital bed out on the sun porch where he could see out to the lake and the canal and see all the birds and the crazy iguanas and critters out there. And he died a little over 2 years ago with no pain medication, with no pain. And the last thing he said to me was, I love you too. And, and I'm going to cry. But that night that he died, you know, they came and they got him. And I woke up the next morning, and I had the mother of all panic attacks. My heart was going 1,000 miles an hour, and I had no idea what I was going to do because I had done with him for 28 solid, beautiful, sober years. And my house filled up with you guys. You were everywhere. I couldn't get away from you. And my brain said to me, you know, a shot of vodka would stop this panic attack, which is true, it would have. But I was talking to a friend this morning, and I said that the 8 million meetings that I had been to, you know how they give you that thing about, oh, you have a toolbox, and every meeting gives you a little tool, and I used to think, oh, shut up. And but I had all those tools, and what I had in that toolbox was all the people who had gone out and come back, and not a one of them told me it was any good, or that it fixed anything, or it did anything for them, or made them feel better. So I figured the shot of vodka was probably not going to do it, and you guys saved my butt. Like 300 people showed up at his funeral. I tried to tell them at Crayer. And I tried to tell them about the three-piece suits and the leather and the motorcycles. And they just go, oh, it's, don't worry about it. And they were going, oh, my God, we better open another room. And then they went, oh, we better open the other room. And just you all came because you loved him. And my children came because they loved me. And it was a beautiful thing. And then a year ago, we brought his ashes up here. And Artie's in the lake back there in the Vespers area if you want to go visit him. So then I had to be this person that I didn't know. She didn't exist yet. This woman who did it alone, who did it on her own. Of course, I don't do anything alone. But, I mean, I had to learn, like, where the pliers were and where the hammer was and how to change the filter on the air conditioner and how to get the stuff down off the top shelf, let alone sleeping alone in the bed. The first year was very hard, but you guys rock. On the first Valentine's Day that he was gone, some of the ladies in the front row and a million other people marched into my living room with their arms full of pink roses, teddy bears, and chocolate candy because they didn't want me to spend my first Valentine's Day alone. I still have the teddy bear. And this year, I think I found my feet. I think my feet are under me. I think I know. It's amazing. People have always said to me, oh, you're so strong. And I'd go, no, I'm not. I really just want the white knight to come on the horse and take care of me. But I have found that I am strong. And I have found that I am proud of that. And I'm looking at the clock. How long, Karen? I have found that I can stay sober. I have been blessed with a group of young girls who are my grand sponsees. Two of them are here this weekend. And their sponsor said to me, they are watching you. They are waiting to see if you are going to drink. I said, I'm not going to drink. But it turned out to be a lesson for them, too, because she sicked one of them on me. She said, okay, I want you to be in touch with her every day. You make sure she sounds good. You get in touch with her and you get to know her. Every morning of my life, I get a text message from Anne. Every morning of my life, if a morning went by and I didn't hear from her, I'd go over there and see if she was okay. They call me. They come around. They hold me up. They bless me on a daily basis, all these young, beautiful girls. And so I have a new family now. I'm not a married woman anymore, but I am a full, happy woman. Next month, I'm going to be a grandma. Oh, my God, I'm so excited. My kids are doing well. I'm doing well. My house has not fallen down without a man in it. And it's all because I got down on my knees that morning, and I do it often with lots of different problems and issues, and said, I can't do this. You take it. And he does. Every single time. And you guys taught me that, and I will always, always be grateful. Thank you.